Welcome, IRIS listeners, to Hour 3 of the Des Moines Register. My name is Dale Finnegan. I'll be your reader for this hour. We'll begin, as always, with the obituaries. Wilma Sue Burt, a private family memorial service for Wilma Sue Burt, 85, of rural Cooper in Greene County and formerly of Des Moines, will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, February 27th at Slininger Schroeder Funeral Home in Jefferson. Sue died early on Tuesday, February 23rd at Greene County Medical Center in Jefferson after a heart attack. Friends may watch the live streamed service on Facebook at the Slininger Schroeder Funeral Home website. There is a complicated link for that in this obituary, so if you'd like that information, please give us a call. In lieu of flowers, memorials are suggested for Windsor Heights Lutheran Church of Des Moines or the Jefferson Public Library. Sue was born in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and moved to the Des Moines area as a small child. Her parents, John and Edwina Olson, operated a paint and wallpaper store in the Valley Junction district of West Des Moines. Later, she welcomed a sister, Karen. A 1953 graduate of Roosevelt High School in Des Moines, Sue began working in the offices of local businesses and soon met Carl W. Burt of Fort Dodge. After a rapid courtship, they married in 1954 and eventually had three daughters, Tammy, Carla, and Chris. Carl died in 1996. Sue's longtime career was a secretary in the Des Moines Public Schools, concluding at McCombs Middle School. She was a lifetime member of Windsor Heights Lutheran Church in the western Des Moines suburb, but for 30 years was also a founding member of Christ Lutheran Church in southern Des Moines, and in late years, a friend of another Christ Lutheran Church, this one in Jefferson. She was a loyal member of PEO Chapter GY, a steady reader, an enthusiastic camper with her family in Iowa State parks, later a bicyclist and a dedicated baseball fan, who in the 1990s and early aughts attended games in all the Major League Baseball stadiums. For several summers, she also had season tickets for the Iowa Cubs games in Des Moines. She preferred keeping her own scorecard and did not appreciate extra inning games. Survivors include her daughters, Tammy Amsbaugh of Des Moines and spouse John, Carla Offenberger and spouse Chuck of rural Cooper, and Christine Woods and spouse Tony of Des Moines. Her grandchildren, Carrie Shippey, spouse Scott, Jenny Amsbaugh, spouse Jenny, Janae Janes Learned, spouse Chris, Andrew Offenberger, spouse Maria, Perry Wheaton, spouse Gerald, and Harrison Woods. And great-great-great-grandchildren, Tyler Shippey, Myla Shippey, Connor Janes, Lindsay Offenberger, Casey Offenberger, Audrey Offenberger, Ariana Morrow, Jada Wheaton, Cody Amsbaugh, Brady Amsbaugh, a sister, Karen Wiles, and spouse Dave, a niece, Stephanie Wiles Jeffrey, and spouse Chris, other distant relatives, and many friends. Interment will be at Sunset Memorial Gardens in Des Moines. Matthew McLaren. It is with great sadness that we announce the passing of Matthew McLaren, born August 17, 1958, died February 23rd. Beloved brother, father, and grandfather, Matt will be cremated and a celebration of his life will be held later this year. Wayne Arthur Morrow, age 80, departed this life early Sunday morning, February 21st, with family by his side. Visitation and viewing with family at 1 p.m. on Saturday, February 27th, with homegoing celebration services at 2 p.m. at the King of Kings Baptist Church, 619 Southeast 15th Street. Burial Monday at 2 p.m. at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery. He is survived by his wife, Wilma Jean Morrow, his daughter, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and a brother. Doris Nadine Moen, 96, peacefully passed away on Monday, February 22nd. A visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. on Sunday, February 28th at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. Joseph Blair, 39, of Altoona, passed away unexpectedly on February 19th. Joseph was born January 20th, 1982, to Cindy and Mike Blair. He lived his entire life in Iowa and enjoyed working outdoors at a variety of construction jobs. Joseph was looking forward to starting a new training program in March to become a bricklayer. Joseph was a voracious reader, spent hours binge-watching Doctor Who, loved all animals, and enjoyed engaging anyone and everyone in political debates. His favorite activity was spending time with his beloved daughters. Joseph is survived by daughters Sybil and Riley Jo, grandmother Lorna Roos, sister Lorna Blair, mothers of his children Alexandra Blair and Taylor Conway, many friends and extended family. He is preceded in death by his mother Cindy Blair and grandfather Bud Roos. There will be no traditional funeral service or visitation. Remembrances can be posted on Joseph's Facebook page or at his Des Moines Register obituary notification. The family requests those wishing to express sympathy consider a donation in Joseph's name to the Animal Rescue League of Iowa in support of their PAWS, P-A-W-S, program. You can mail a donation to ARL 5452 Northeast 22nd Street, Des Moines, Iowa, 50313, or make a gift in Joseph's memory on their website at arl-iowa.org. That concludes the obituaries for today. I'll turn to the sports section of the Register now. The article featured in the center of the page is Iowa tennis players send message on, quote, final ride. They wear red in protest of program's elimination. And this article is written by Chad Leistikow. The exact dates flow freely from the tongue of University of Iowa men's tennis player Jason Kirst, as if they're seared in his memory forever, an indication of the scars associated with them. March 12th, the day the NCAA canceled spring sports championships due to the COVID-19 pandemic, as the Hawkeyes were on the verge of a historic program breakthrough. August 21st, the day he and athletes from four Iowa sports were coldly informed by athletics director Gary Barta that their programs were being eliminated after the current academic year. But as Kirst references the painful dates, it's only to describe the immense joy that he and fellow Hawkeyes found last Friday after a convincing home win against Indiana to mark the program's first regular season win against the Hoosiers since 2009, and the first team win of any kind since March 8, 2020. It was a joy they didn't know was possible to rediscover after what's been a remarkably trying 12 months. Smiles illuminated the locker room. Music boomed. Happy players stomped on chairs. Honestly, the pain and frustration, for a few minutes, just really did melt away. It was so cool, Kirst says, getting a touch emotional. Looking back to March 12th or August 21st, I really didn't know a moment like that would come again. 48 hours later, after a Sunday thumping of Purdue and securing a 2-0 Big Ten conference start, they again felt a similar jolt of joy in their locker room. I know once these 3 months are over, Kirst says, those are the kinds of moments that I'll never forget. The moments were powerfully captured in a photo that began circulating on social media last week. A huddle of Hawkeye players, the nine of them who are sticking it out for one final season, were shown on the court in red t-shirts. Third-year player Nikita Snesko of Plymouth, Minnesota, posted the photo and this caption. Since they don't want our team, we don't want their colors. Playing for my brothers until the end. End quote. The move to red came after back-to-back season opening losses to Virginia and Middle Tennessee State. Will Davies, a fourth-year player from England, describes a team that was still reeling from the off-season emotions of their sport being eliminated. Now, Iowa is 2-0 in red. It took most, if not all, of the team a fair amount of time to come to terms with the decision, Davies said. I think that actually spilled over into the first couple of matches that we played. What started as an idea between a few players flourished into a team-wide rallying cry. You could understand the pain associated at the thought of seeing each other in black and gold, but to see each other in red is an on-court reminder that this tight-knit group of guys, five players originally from England, one from Dubai, and three from the U.S., is prioritizing the relationships they've formed ahead of the school that's cutting them loose, especially for guys who have made long-term investments in the program, like Kareem Alaf in his sixth year, and Kirst in his fifth, and Davies and Joe Tyler in their fourth. This is their chance to send a message. Anyone who watches our team can see how gritty we are, how passionate we are. If you look through our photos for matches, it's just people roaring and fist-pumping like crazy. Kirst says, I think the red shirts are an embodiment of that for us right now. We are standing unified. We've been dealt all these really challenging cards, and we're still here. We're still fighting. We're not going down anytime soon. Why red? There's a funny story about that. We went to a store and had to find enough shirts of different sizes that would get the whole team sorted, Davy says, in his British accent. And that happened to be the color. There you go. Men's tennis coach Ross Wilson declined to be interviewed for this story, instead wanting the focus to be on his athletes moving forward. While recent developments from a Title IX lawsuit have forced BARDA to bring back women's swimming from the chopping block, three men's sports, tennis, gymnastics, and swimming, are in their final days. And rather than being consumed by disappointment and anger, this Iowa tennis team intends to write a final, triumphant chapter. Iowa has never qualified for the NCAA tournament in tennis. The Hawkeyes almost certainly were going to make it last season, until the global pandemic hit. Five of the six starters from that team are back. The Hawkeyes finished 12th out of 12 teams in the Big Ten before Kirst arrived in June of 2016. The next year, under Wilson, they were 10th. The next year, they were 8th. The next year, they were 6th. Then came last year's program record number 20 national ranking. Now they have a chance to finish their climb. They want the last men's tennis team at University of Iowa history to be remembered as the best. A 3 p.m. home match Sunday versus Nebraska is next. The next month or so is going to be crucial, Davy says. We need to keep building on what we did last weekend. The Big Ten championships are scheduled for April 29th to May 2nd in Lincoln, Nebraska. The Hawkeyes, 2-2 overall, hope there will be a 64-team NCAA championship in late May as usual. But they know with COVID-19, anything could happen. They nervously wait. They haven't sought out further conversations with UI's administration. They want to minimize distractions, Kirst says, until they've played their final point at Iowa. Obviously, we know that the number of matches that we play this year are going to be limited, and that's it. And then that's it, Davies adds. So I'd say there's a bit more passion. We're just enjoying the final ride. Along the side of the page is an article by Tommy Birch. The title is ISU Women Improve Their NCAA Status with Quality Win. The dateline is Ames. Following a historic win at Baylor this season, the consensus seemed to be that the Iowa State women were well on their way to an NCAA tournament berth. All the Cyclones had to do was avoid ugly losses and pad their resume as much as they could. The Cyclones have managed to avoid any unexpected defeats, and on Wednesday, they added to their resume in a big way. The Cyclones rolled past number 22 West Virginia, beating the Mountaineers 85-68 at Hilton Coliseum on Wednesday night. The victory was Iowa State's second against a ranked team, as the Cyclones improved to 15-9 overall, 11-6 in the Big 12 Conference. Iowa State's last win over a ranked team came at Baylor on January 16th, ending a 61-game home winning streak for the Lady Bears. Wednesday's victory wasn't as big, but upsetting West Virginia was important, and the Cyclones had little trouble doing it. I think it does a lot, Iowa State coach Bill Fennelly said of the victory. Obviously, it's another quality win. It's another win that adds to the resume that every team is trying to build right now. Five players scored in double figures for the Cyclones, who got a team-high 20 points from Ashley Jones. The Cyclones shot 48% from three-point range and took control of the game early on. They started getting momentum in the first quarter with a 10-0 run, and then outscored West Virginia 20-14 in the second. The third quarter was when the Cyclones really took control of the game. They used an 11-0 run to take a 66-47 lead in the third quarter. It was highlighted by three-pointers by Madison Wise, Kylie Feuerbach, and Lexi Donarski. The third quarter, and the middle of the fourth, we were probably as good as we could be, Fennelly said. Iowa State led 66-50 heading into the fourth quarter and never let up on a shorthanded West Virginia squad that fell to 17-4 on the season and 11-4 in Big 12 play. Here's what we learned. There was plenty of balance. Jones has led the way for Iowa State so many times this season. She sometimes has lacked a strong supporting cast. This was not the case Wednesday. Five players scored in double figures for Iowa State. Jones was 5 of 13 from the field and 9 of 9 from the free throw line. Donarski and Kristen Scott both added 18 points. Emily Ryan finished with 13 and Feuerbach chipped in with 10. We got a lot of open threes and my teammates really knocked them down and kind of helped us get on a run, Jones said. This was among Emily Ryan's best games. The freshman has had plenty of big games this season, but Wednesday's may have been her most efficient. Ryan teased a triple-double, scoring 13 points, grabbing 5 rebounds, and handing out 9 assists. The most impressive number on her stat line may have been 1 turnover. It was a strong turnaround from her last game when Ryan tallied a career-high 8 turnovers in Iowa State's loss at Oklahoma State. Obviously, taking care of the ball was huge, Ryan said. That was emphasized several times this week at practice. Wednesday was about the seniors. It wasn't the final home game of the regular season, but Iowa State still honored its 3 seniors Wednesday night. Senior night was scheduled to take place Wednesday when the schedule was originally released. But when Iowa State's game against Kansas got postponed earlier in the season and moved to March 3rd, that became the final home game. Iowa State stuck with the plan and honored the 3 Wednesday. The most unique part of the celebration included Fennelly starting Wise and Ray Johnson alongside Scott, already a regular in the lineup. The 3 were then introduced by family members with pre-recorded messages. And near the bottom of the page, there are a couple more articles that I'll read. The first is a special to the Des Moines Register from Cedar Falls. Drake women complete season sweep of UNI. The Drake women's basketball team earned a season sweep over in-state rival Northern Iowa with a 77-56 win Wednesday night at the McLeod Center. Grace Berg had the hot hand early for the Bulldogs, pouring in 8 points in the opening 5 minutes of action, as Drake, 13-10 overall, 11-5 in the MVC, held a 16-15 advantage after the first quarter. Berg finished with a game-high 18 points. Drake limited UNI, which entered as the Valley's second-highest scoring team behind the Bulldogs, to 18 of 71 shooting on the night. That 25.4% represents the Panthers' lowest mark of the season. After closing the first half on a quick 5-0 burst, the Bulldogs opened the second half on a 13-2 run to take a 48-33 advantage, their largest of the game to that point. Kiara Collier, who finished with 16 points on 6 of 9 shooting, netted 10 points during the pivotal stretch. The Bulldogs shot 81.3% from the field in the third period compared to UNI's 22.2% mark. Taylor McCauley found Monica Burridge for a buzzer-beating layup to cap a quarter in which Drake outscored UNI 30-11. The play was indicative of the Bulldogs' superior ball movement as they recorded 27 assists, tied for their second most of the year. Maggie Baer notched her 4th double-double of the season with 10 points and a game-best 10 rebounds in just 19 minutes. Burridge added 12 points and 5 rebounds, and the two were a major factor in Drake outscoring UNI 36-14 in the paint and earning a 50-38 rebound advantage. Maddie Monahan and Allie Wooldridge each had 6 points and 5 assists, while Courtney Becker had 5 points and 6 rebounds off the bench. Drake closes its regular season slate with a pair of home contests against Valparaiso on March 5th and 6th. To finish up here, I'll read Matthew Bain's article at the bottom of the page, Ready for Some Intense Hoops? 4A Boys Substate Semis on Tap. It's hard to match the intensity of high-stakes substate basketball games. Sure, the state basketball tournament is every kid's dream. Playing in front of a big crowd in Wells Fargo Arena is a once-in-a-lifetime experience. But just getting to the well, you could argue, is also a once-in-a-lifetime experience. State basketball is win or go home. But even if you lose, you've already made it. You've already checked a huge item off your high school bucket list. That's why sub-state games, especially the semifinals and finals, are a different beast. These teams are putting everything on the line for a chance to make their state tournament dreams come true. And they're doing it in a small, sometimes very small, high school gym, where you can cut through emotions with a knife. Class 4A's sub-state semifinals take place this Friday night at 7 p.m. Here are five that could come down to the wire and be some of the most intense games of the season. Substate 1, Sioux City East at Southeast Polk. Southeast Polk, with an 11-7 record, is a true middle-of-the-pack CIML team this year. The Rams' offense and defense are both decent. They managed to go 11-7 while playing the sixth toughest schedule in 4A. They're battle-tested and experienced. Sioux City East, 13-9, meanwhile, boasts a high-octane offense led by point guard Devarius Whitaker, one of the state's most prolific scorers. The Black Raiders' offense is second in 4A only to Cedar Falls, but they played the class's fourth weakest schedule. This is a battle between a premier Western Iowa program and a solid CIML one. Western Iowa teams struggle to gain respect around Iowa because they play a weaker schedule. A win here could help reverse that storyline, at least for this winter. Substate 2, Des Moines Hoover at number 3, Ames. Some might be wondering why this game is on the list. The Little Cyclones, 15-3, have rattled off 10 straight wins and have established themselves as the second-tier CIML team behind the loaded Waukee Warriors. They also have the class's number 2 defense. Des Moines Hoover, 13-4, has 2 blowout losses against Ankeny and Des Moines North. But the up-and-down Huskies also have impressive wins against Southeast Polk and most recently, then number 4, West Des Moines Valley. This is a young team with a pair of high-end sophomores in Elijah Voss and Chase Henderson, and senior Manny Austin is playing the best basketball of his life. Crazier things than a Hoover upset Friday night have happened. Substate 3, Ottumwa at Cedar Rapids Kennedy. For the first time since 2008-9, Ottumwa, 16-5, finished the regular season with a winning record. If the Bulldogs were ever going to make noise in the postseason, this is the year to do it. 4 of their 5 leading scorers are seniors, including Trey Swartz, a 6'5" Iowa Western football signee, who is also pretty dang good at basketball. He averages 19.3 points and 5.4 rebounds per game. The problem for Ottumwa fans? Cedar Rapids Kennedy, 14-7, is quite good. After an iffy start to the season, the Cougars have won 10 of their past 11 games, dating to January 19th, and their only loss came to undefeated Cedar Falls. They beat teams such as number 4 Dubuque Hempstead, Cedar Rapids Washington, Xavier, number 8 Dowling Catholic, and Iowa City Liberty during that stretch. This game pits a traditionally strong Mississippi Valley Conference team against a surprisingly good CIML squad. MVC versus CIML battles are always fun, as those two conferences often battle for Iowa supremacy. Substate 5, Muscatine at North Scott. Although a relative down year for North Scott's program, it still has a mean defense that allows the third fewest points in 4A. And it's still netted impressive wins over Davenport North and Pleasant Valley this season. The Lancers, 11-7, don't have anything to worry about here, right? Wrong, because 2 of those 7 losses came to Muscatine, who are 10-10. For whatever reason, the Muskies have had North Scott's number this winter. The games have been close, though. Muscatine won 51-48 in overtime a couple weeks ago, and it won 51-46 back on January 8th, although it did lead that game 31-18 after three quarters. Substate 6, Davenport North versus Iowa City Liberty. This is perhaps the toughest substate semifinal to predict. Or is it? Iowa City Liberty, 6-5, had its schedule Swiss cheesed by COVID-19 postponements and cancellations, so their legs are fresh. But they also might not have as great a team rhythm as other rosters around Iowa. After starting their season 5-0 with solid wins over Iowa City High and Prairie, the Lightning have gone 1-5 and had lost four straight games before topping Keokuk last week. Liberty is just so hard to get a read on. So Davenport North, 13-5, might cautiously feel good about this game, even though it's at Liberty, because the Lightning hadn't been struggling as much when the Iowa High School Athletic Association assigned seeds. The Wildcats are a dark horse to upset their way through this substate. They've won seven straight games, including a victory over Davenport Assumption and a 57-35 win over North Scott. That does it for sports today. I will move on to the Iowa Life section now in the Register. The article featured here is titled, Tom and Jerry Are Back. Director Tim Story brings the classic cartoon rivals back to the big screen and small screens. There is an illustration with this article. I believe it's the top of the Empire State Building in the center of the page with the blue sky in the background. The cat, I believe that's Tom, is standing atop the Empire State Building holding on to the spire with one hand and trying to grab menacingly with his other hand towards Jerry, the mouse, who is flying past them in a biplane, a two-winged airplane. And here is the story as written by Ed Simkus of the USA Today Network. Tim Story was enjoying a hot career directing music videos throughout the late 1990s when he took the step up to feature films. He scored with a couple of hits, Barbershop and Taxi. He met with less box office success when he brought two Fantastic Four films to the screen, then had more winners with Think Like a Man, Ride Along, and their sequels. His terrific 2019 reboot of the Shaft series was underappreciated, but around the time he was making it, something very different came his way. A script and an offer to direct the Oscar-winning cartoon rivals Tom and Jerry and a feature film that would merge animation and live-action characters, including Chloe Grace Moretz and Michael Peña, and place them all in the midst of contemporary Manhattan. Story, a longtime fan of Hanna-Barbera's Tom and Jerry shorts, jumped at the opportunity. He spoke about the film during a Zoom chat from his home in Los Angeles. First question. You were a kid in the 1970s watching Tom and Jerry on TV. Who else were you watching back then? Oh, there were so many different cartoons I watched. The Jetsons, the Flintstones, and everything from Kimba to Popeye. But I remember that Tom and Jerry were on all the time, every afternoon when I came home from school. I was fixated on them. When you were first asked to do this film with these iconic characters, were you at all nervous? Sure, I wasn't having any second thoughts about it. But when you finally say, I want to do this, you know that a lot of people are going to have an opinion of how you bring it to life. But I felt comfortable in what these characters were to me. I felt that I had so much love for them that I wouldn't let the Hanna-Barbera world down. What were the first things you did to prepare for it? I went back and watched some of the old classic cartoons. I even watched a bit of Charlie Chaplin because I was looking for any inspiration that would allow me to figure out how to get a lot of humor and storytelling with characters that don't speak. Part of the reason the old shorts worked so well was the crazy sound effects that accompanied the wild action. Was I hearing the actual sounds from the cartoons in your film? Yeah, we used a lot of the original sounds from the cartoons. We got some of Tom's screams from the archives, and we found some of the actual impacts of the characters hitting each other. We would sometimes put those sounds into the mix, but also give them more beef. That leads to the question of violence in these cartoons. They were very violent, in a creative way, and your film is too. In these PC times, did that cause any problems with the studio? No. I remember asking the Warner Brothers folks if they had any reservations about us taking the violence where we wanted to go. They said no. They said, make a Tom and Jerry cartoon. The question I am still getting asked is, did you water down the violence? I always say no. We made it a point to stick right to what these characters would do. There's also a quick scene near the end where two cartoon elephants are startled. One says, OMG. The other says a slightly muffled, WTF. How did you get that one by the censors? We just went for it. Like with all films, we had to go through a ratings board, and our film continued to pass the test. You put it in, and Warner Brothers doesn't say anything to you. Then you give it to the ratings board, and they don't say anything. We just wanted to be sure that we made something that spoke to all audiences, and we found that anytime we could wink at that, we made it a point to do so. But I hope we haven't given any moms and dads a reason to turn off the TV. What do your own kids think of the film? They're 16, 14, and 9. My older ones aren't watching cartoons that much, but my 9-year-old definitely is. I was able to introduce him to Tom and Jerry 2 years ago when I first got this film. He didn't know who they were, so I sat him down and let him watch them, and he must have watched 7 in a row. He has seen the new film in several stages, and luckily, he got the same thing that I got from them when I was young. Tom and Jerry opens in selected theaters and premieres on HBO Max on February 26th. The final article in this section is by Brian Alexander from the USA Today. It's titled, How Flora and Ulysses Turned a Squirrel into a Superhero. The time has come for even squirrels to step up into movie superhero stardom. In Flora and Ulysses, now streaming on Disney Plus, young human Flora, played by Matilda Lawler, saves a squirrel's life, only to find the food-crazy mammal, Ulysses, has extraordinary powers. It was tough to keep the squirrel grounded in a sense of reality, in keeping with the character from the beloved Newbery Medal-winning 2013 children's book, Flora and Ulysses, while also making Ulysses a hero with powers of flight, the ability to comprehend humans, and the desire to fight injustice. I wanted Ulysses to be a legit, hardcore force of nature, says director Lena Khan. Veteran voice actor John Cassier was daunted voicing his first screen squirrel without human words. Relying on his own experience observing the critters around his home, Cassier threw out what became squirrel jazz in the studio, bridging the gap between human emotions and realistic squirrel sounds. Khan loved it, especially his squirrel munching. Ulysses eats with a tremendous amount of satisfaction, and if ever someone could find 10 different ways to eat in squirrel language, John did, says Khan. And there is a cute little photograph along with this short article of the squirrel Ulysses as he makes a heroic landing after flying through the air in Flora and Ulysses. And the caption says that real squirrels strike the same pose, ... when scratching. And you can see the classic hero, superhero landing pose where it's landing on its two back feet supported by one leg or paw or arm on the ground in front supporting it and the other one up in the air in that strong athletic pose. That does it for the Register today. I'll turn now to the USA Today and begin with the short Moneyline articles. Mr. Potato Head is going gender neutral. Mr. Potato Head is no longer a mister. Hasbro, the company that makes the potato-shaped plastic toy, is giving the Spud a gender neutral new name, Potato Head. The change will appear on boxes this year. Toy makers have been updating their classic brands to appeal to today's kids. Barbie has shed its blonde image and now comes in multiple skin tones and body shapes. Thomas the Tank Engine added more girl characters, and American Girl is now selling a boy doll. Hasbro said Mr. Potato Head, which has been around for about 70 years, needed a modern makeover. Costco to raise minimum wage to $16 an hour. Costco is raising its minimum wage to $16 an hour, leapfrogging competitors including Target and Amazon. Costco CEO Craig Jelinek announced the increase Thursday at a U.S. Senate Budget Committee hearing on worker wages at large companies. Said Jelinek, 2 years ago, we moved our starting hourly wage to $15 everywhere in the U.S. Effective next week, the starting wage will go to $16. The wholesale chain already is paying many of its 180,000 U.S. workers a much higher rate. Jelinek said the average wage for hourly workers is around $24 per hour. Jobless claims fell sharply last week. The number of Americans seeking unemployment benefits fell sharply last week in a sign that layoffs may have eased, though applications for aid remain at a historically high level. Jobless claims declined by 111,000 from the previous week to a seasonally adjusted 730,000, the Labor Department said Thursday. It is the lowest figure since late November. Also on this page is this article written by Jessica Gwynn. Report: Facebook spread lie about Texas power outage. Misleading claims shared by prominent conservatives that wind turbines caused massive winter storm power outages in Texas whipped through Facebook without fact-checking labels, racking up millions of views, according to a new report shared exclusively with USA Today. Human rights group Avaaz says the 10 top-performing posts about wind turbine failures from public figures such as Fox News personalities Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity and former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee received more than 15.8 million views on Facebook. As of Tuesday, none of the posts had a fact-checking label, including those reviewed by Facebook's fact-checking partners. USA Today's fact check found the claim that frozen wind turbines were to blame for blackouts in Texas was missing context. Some wind turbines froze because they were not built to withstand the unusually cold temperatures. But the most substantial energy losses were from the shutdowns of thermal power plants. According to the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, which operates the state's power grid, natural gas, coal, and nuclear energy plants were responsible for almost twice as many power outages as frozen wind turbines and solar panels. When a page, group, or post violates our policies, we either remove it or label it depending on the violation, and we follow the same approach with the examples identified in the Avaaz report, Facebook said in a statement. We remain the only company to partner with more than 80 fact-checking organizations and use AI to scale those fact checks against millions of duplicate posts across our platform. There is no playbook for a program like ours, and we work to improve it all the time, end quote. The false claims began with the image of a helicopter de-icing wind turbines that was passed off as a photo from the deadly Texas storm that left millions without food, water, or heat. The photo was, in fact, taken in Sweden in 2014, according to research this week from the German Marshall Fund. Gaining steam, the claims spread quickly on YouTube, where they had 1.8 million views and generated 1 million likes, comments, and shares on Facebook, the think tank found. On Twitter, a tweet with the embedded image was retweeted 30,000 times. The Avaaz report found that Facebook, in most cases, slapped a fact-checking label on the helicopter image. Facebook let irresponsible myths reach millions without intervention, going against its very own policies, Fadi Karan, campaign director at Avaaz, said. The company should know by now that during any crisis, disinformation spreads like wildfire, and its negligence and algorithms are the fuel, end quote. The flood of misleading narratives about the Texas power outages is part of a growing trend of disinformation campaigns popping up when extreme weather patterns sweep the country. Social media companies are under growing pressure from environmental groups and Democratic lawmakers to stop the spread of climate change hoaxes and conspiracy theories. They warn that the Biden administration efforts to increase investment in renewable energy while cutting oil, gas, and coal emissions could be undermined by falsehoods on social media. Disinformation content targeting these efforts is only likely to increase in the coming months and years, particularly given a concerted effort to shift public opinion against these efforts, the Avaaz report said. In September, Facebook said it would counter climate change misinformation with a climate science information center that supplies users with science-based facts. We are very aggressively removing content that could lead folks into harm's way, and we are surfacing more content that can get them the help and support that they need, Facebook Chief Product Officer Chris Cox told USA Today at the time. During any weather-related or disaster-like event, we have teams pay a lot closer attention to what's going on in those areas to understand what's happening to the information ecosystem. And that's just part of the work we do to make sure the platform is providing the right information in times of crisis. Facebook's announcement came just days after emergency responders in the Pacific Northwest had to fight misinformation on Facebook along with catastrophic wildfires. Climate scientists said the half measures, in quotes, did too little to rein in false, misleading, or disputed information, such as the discredited theory that the government is using, quote, chemtrails to manipulate the weather. The consequences are that the public is far less informed about climate change than they need to be, Michael E. Mann, director of Penn State University's Earth System Science Center, told USA Today. It is very convenient for polluting interests who don't want to see climate policies move forward, end quote. Last week, Facebook said it has added a new feature to its Climate Change Information Center that offers facts that debunk common climate myths. The Avaaz report says Facebook must do more to correct the record. When independent fact-checkers determine that a piece of content is false or misleading, Facebook should show a retroactive correction to each and every user who viewed, interacted with, or shared it. This can cut belief in false and misleading information by nearly half, the group said. Facebook should also reduce the reach of pages or groups that repeatedly share climate change misinformation, Avaaz said. Turning a couple pages, I'll go ahead and read these short Lifeline articles from the USA Today's Life section. The first one is the Making Waves feature. This is about Lady Gaga. The singer's dog walker was shot late Wednesday in Hollywood, and two of her French bulldogs, Koji and Gustav, were stolen. A man in his 30s was walking three dogs when a male suspect approached and shot him, according to Los Angeles Police Department Public Information Officer Drake Madison. LAPD says the suspect took two of the dogs and drove off in a white vehicle, while a third dog fled and was later recovered. The A Star Is Born singer, who is in Italy, is offering a $500,000 reward for the return of her pets. Lady Gaga's representative, Amanda Silverman, confirmed to USA Today. Interestingly, there's no mention of how that shot dog walker is doing. Following that, in the They Said What feature, we have a Star's Best quote from Jill Biden. My mother always said to me, things are going to look better tomorrow. I look back on it now, and I think if I hadn't gotten divorced, I never would have met Joe. I wouldn't have the beautiful family I have now. So I really think things happen for the best. I think over time, you heal. And again, that was First Lady Jill Biden to Kelly Clarkson on an episode of The Singer's talk show that aired Thursday as she was trying to give Clarkson hope amid her divorce woes. And here's an article with some advice from Elizabeth Wise of the USA Today. The title, Want to Hug Again? Get the vaccine, ad urges. Prepare for an onslaught of ads reminding us of all the things we miss about life before the pandemic. Hugs, going to church, family gatherings, and hanging with friends. And information about how COVID-19 vaccines can bring them back. The ad campaign from the Ad Council will include more than $500 million in donated media and talent. It launched Thursday and will slowly change as the landscape of who's eligible for a vaccine and what questions they have shifts. "We're dealing with the biggest issues of our lifetime," said the Ad Council's president and CEO, Lisa Sherman. "We recognized pretty quickly that unless people could learn more about the vaccine and get educated, they may not take them. And then we wouldn't be any better off next year than we are this year." The ads are aimed at the 40% of Americans who haven't yet made up their minds about getting vaccinated, Sherman said. The Ad Council focused on in-depth focus groups and surveys to understand what questions people had and what their worries were. The result is a website, getvaccineanswers.org, that gives a simple message. Having questions is good. It's normal to be cautious when something new comes along. Answers are available. The ads, which will appear on TV, radio, and online, tug on the heartstrings. They feature images of people holding hands, families at a child's birthday, people walking into church together, or friends sharing pizza side by side. A reminder of how much things have changed in a year. The tagline to all is, "It's up to you." Not to get vaccinated, but to get informed, Sherman said. The ads strike a positive and engaging tone, one that's not mandating, but inviting them into the process of getting the facts from a trusted source, she said. The Ad Council is a nonprofit that creates and distributes public service announcements. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Department of Health and Human Services provided scientific guidance. Some of the ads will be seen broadly on television, but they will be especially focused on communities with high levels of vaccine hesitancy, especially Hispanic and Black communities. That will include campaigns that are credible and culturally relevant. The overall message is the same, but it might be presented slightly differently. For the Hispanic population, there's more of an emotive angle, said Charisse Nunez, Insights lead for the Ad Council's COVID-19 Vaccine Education Initiative. "We knew there were many people who hadn't had the opportunity to visit their family, and so that's something they miss." For the Black community, images of family reunions, going to church, and graduations resonated. The Ad Council is collaborating with multiple partners, including the Black Coalition Against COVID-19, Color of Change, the NAACP, the National Alliance for Hispanic Health, the National Hispanic Medical Association, the National Medical Association, the National Urban League, Unidos US, the United States Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, and others. There's also a National Faith Steering Committee with more than 20 influential faith leaders from the Hispanic and Black communities. There are also online elements. There will be a vaccine-supportive emoji on Twitter, custom content on Facebook, and a campaign among TikTok creators and within the gaming community. The benefits will become apparent as more people see that vaccination contributes to fewer hospitalizations and as people are able to return to schools, universities, and a more normal daily life, said Glenn Nowak, director of the Center for Health and Risk Communication at the University of Georgia. The campaign will continue for months. That's important because while the number of people going into hospitals and dying is waning now, it could be simply another cycle of the pandemic, said Dr. Jesse Goodman, professor of medicine and infectious diseases at Georgetown University. "A month ago, everybody was completely panicked," he said. "Now people are seeing these numbers come down. We've got to have a steady ship in terms of the public health messaging." Alongside that are a couple short articles from the coronavirus news briefing. Pfizer to test booster shots to protect from virus variants. Pfizer-BioNTech will begin testing a booster shot to combat COVID-19 variants, the company announced Thursday, one day after new research published in the New England Journal of Medicine confirmed that two doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine cut symptomatic COVID-19 cases across all age groups by 94%. Now, the two-company collaboration has asked 144 volunteers who participated in the earliest phase of its clinical trials last year to volunteer again to receive the booster, a third shot of the same vaccine designed to see whether it will help them fight off new, more infectious variants that have been circulating in recent months. It's not yet clear whether a new vaccine or booster will be needed to address the known variants, but companies want to be prepared if studies show a new vaccine is needed. The U.S. has more than 28.3 million confirmed coronavirus cases and 506,000 deaths, according to Johns Hopkins University data. More than 88.6 million vaccine doses have been distributed in the U.S. and about 66.4 million have been administered, according to the CDC. Fauci says, don't be picky about vaccines. Americans should not try to pick and choose which vaccine they get, but should take the first one available, Dr. Anthony Fauci said Thursday. He warned people not to hold off on getting the one-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine if it soon becomes available, while waiting for the slightly more effective Pfizer or Moderna shots. Fauci also told NBC News a third vaccine becoming available is, quote, nothing but good news. Johnson & Johnson's vaccine offers strong protection against severe COVID-19. Fauci said it's a race between the virus and getting vaccines into people. And the longer people wait, the better chance the virus has to get a variant or a mutation. Is a new variant spreading in New York? Two preliminary studies have identified a new variant called B1.5.2.6 in New York, although neither study has been through crucial peer review. Michael Neusenzweig, an immunologist at Rockefeller University who was not involved in the new research, told the New York Times that while the discovery is not welcome news, just knowing about it is good because then we can perhaps do something about it. Others have questioned releasing information so early in the vetting process. Nathan Grubaugh, a public health professor at Yale, tweeted that he was, quote, asked to provide comment on someone's draft manuscript that still had tracked changes and didn't include the figures. This is an absolute mess. Dr. Jay Varma, public health advisor to Mayor Bill de Blasio, tweeted a plea to academics. Please review high-impact studies with government health departments before marketing it to media. And now back to the register for Dear Abby. Mom's life has less stress after child's father is incarcerated. That's the headline today. The letter says, Dear Abby, I recently had a child with a man who is now incarcerated. I was widowed when I met him, and although he brought me happiness, it has come at a steep price. I pay for literally everything. I love him very much, but his entitlement was an issue even before he had legal issues. Now he has become very nasty and minimizes everything I do. If I send $100, he's upset that I didn't send $200. If I have a day off from work that I don't spend communicating with a lawyer and the courts, I'm, quote, not taking initiative. He has even gone so far as to say it was my fault he got in trouble because I was on his case so often that he, quote, had to go out to get some peace, end quote. His only redeeming quality is his wonderful relationship with the kids, who see none of our fights and regard him as a father figure. He is now even more negative and derogatory than when he was at home. I manage a busy restaurant and a household of five children. Since he has been away, I'm ashamed to say, life has actually been less stressful. I think my loneliness when I met him made it easier to ignore red flags. In every other aspect of my life, I am an independent woman who has the respect of my peers. Is it too late to set boundaries with him? Signed, Growing in Florida. Abby says, Dear Growing, this emotionally abusive individual is milking you like you are a Guernsey cow. His ingratitude is boundless. You are not the reason he got himself in trouble with the law, and it isn't your responsibility to get him out or support him financially. It is way too late to set boundaries with this manipulative ingrate. He won't change. What you must do now, for your sake and for your children's, is to tell him you are finished and cut ties with him. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Des Moines Register for Friday, February 26, 2021. You can hear this show again at 6 p.m. and then again at 1 a.m. Recordings are available on our website, iowaradioreading.org. All material heard on IRIS is intended for the use of Iowans who are print disabled. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call at 515-243-6833. You can also call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa, 1-877-404-4747. Once again, we want you to know that our program schedule has changed so that we can get as much local information to as many listeners as possible. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m. Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m. Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. to noon. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m., 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. And the Midweek Shopping Cart is read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. We will stay with the schedule until further notice. I'm your reader, Dale Finnegan. It's been a pleasure to read for you today. Stay tuned for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. And thank you for listening to Your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.